Accession number 28361, Reel 56.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 56. You were saying that the patrol commander decided he'd better do this on his own.
Yeah. What he was, it was a four-man patrol, and he was able to get quite close, but yes, he wanted to do a really close recce to establish a good start line for the commando attack, and also what we now call a line of departure. Which
and start his line that used to be the
start line exactly and that was to establish a start, and his CO said on the map there's a fence marked, I want you to make certain where it is and the extent of it. So what he did was he had a pistol as well as a rifle. He left his rifle with the patrol so he could, was really lightly armed, and he said to the one of the marines on the patrol who had the radio, they had numbered targets, bring down a quick stonk every 5 minutes, and in under the cover of the noise of the fire I'll just creep forward.
Well, this artillery stonk on
artillery,
water.
Artillery, so this chap did that, and when there was a, you know, quick, you know, five rounds fire for effect or something, in the sort of noise and confusion on the what he thought was the enemy position, which it was, he was able to crawl forward and establish what he'd been told to find. And to me that's the sort of mark of good training, that you can hand the radio over to a marine and say, right, you control the fire while I go forward and do the recce, and then I'll, you know, the sort of coordination. And he did, and he established exactly where it was, the extent of it, and brought it back.
How close to the enemy positions did he get?
He was within, I should say, 100 yards of some of their slip trenches. In very open, you know, that open peat with quite good vision. So he had to sort of creep really low.
And really, really on his belly.
Really on his belly, yeah.
On his belly.
Absolutely, yeah. So that was a good effort. And then there were other patrols that went in and just got in as close as they could and duffed people up.
Well, just going up to the positions and firing into them and then...
Yes, or bringing down mortar fire or artillery fire, yeah. And also trying to take prisoners.
Yes, I was going to ask you whether...
Yeah, we never succeeded in taking any prisoners.
You didn't snatch anyone?
No. One of them tried and got seen and had to leg it.
Did the Argentinians have any listening posts forward of their main line of resistance?
No.
They didn't?
No.
They were just relying on height. And
they were relying on height, and they had laid some minefields which they didn't mark, which is why we lost people on them. I mean, they had no minefield marking at all. In fact, they caused themselves some casualties in that way as well.
Well, they would, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and some mines, they've just got those little, and just tossed them out in the front of their own positions.
What, little personnel mines?
Yeah, little ones, little... you know, the ones, little little things about the size of a boot polish tin.
Yes. Now, that would actually be an illegal use of mine.
Yeah, well, they did, but they did it.
They did it.
Yeah, they did it. Nevertheless, they did it. You can see the different kinds they had here.
Oh, yes. So those are very small ones on the right-hand side.
Yeah.
And presumably that the intention behind those would not be to kill the victim, but to maim them.
Maim them, so they didn't...
Disruption.
Exactly. But their minefields were pretty useless, and they were just a nuisance as well.
Was your close recce man and other patrols, were they able to actually locate the position of the Argentinian support weapons, in other words, the light machine guns and other?
They identified some of them, and the other way that they were identified, certainly the 50 calibers. Was by getting them to fire.
Now, how would you do that? Just show yourself for a moment or something of that sort?
For example, in 4-2 Commando, when they did their attack, which was round the back of the position, they laid on a sort of deception party on the other side. In other words, they were going to go round the back, but on the front of the position, they had another. They had a party of guys sort of shooting and firing and making a lot of noise. And when the Argentine 50 calibers opened up,
yes,
then they would tell their own mortars to fire illuminating and then take on the enemy 50 calibers with Milan. Because in those days, Milan didn't have a night sight. So the only way you could shoot it at night was putting up a mortar illuminating first and then fire. And so it was a sort of coordination between the deception party making a noise to draw fire and then seeing the thing fire, putting up an illuminating and then engaging it with a Milan.
Well, this sounds like fire support as well as deception.
Yeah, yeah. So it actually quite worked. I mean, the 50 calibers were on the whole well protected overhead. So even when shellfire hit them, the bunker they were in, they survived usually.
How was that overhead protection provided? What sort of structure did they?
They usually put them in a place where there was already a natural sort of cave.
Yes.
And then they put a tin over the top, or they'd take a big slab of rock and move it, and then put earth and turves on top of that to turn it into a sort of bunker. And then they'd build up the front with rocks and turves, so they were just, it was just firing through a slit.
That sounds quite formidable.
It was, and a lot of them were well sighted in defilade, and a lot of them were sighted so that they were mutually supported with a sniper with night sights. So if you were attacking a machine gun position, you were quite often taken in the flank by a sniper with night sights. So the layout on their position was quite imaginative, actually.
Was that 50 caliber the thing that you feared most of the Argentine weapons?
Yes, it was one of the key things that made me decide we do all our attacks at night, because of that ability to shoot at long range, direct fire with a very, very formidable weapon,
and fairly open approaches
on very open ground. So exactly,
you'd in effect be on a sort of natural glacis on the
exactly.
way
out. Yes.
Yeah. And you said that Milan could engage these weapons to good effect. You seem to be implying that artillery and mortars really couldn't reach them because of the overhead cover.
It could suppress them to the extent that it would, they would tend to keep quiet under artillery and mortar fire. But as soon as it lifted, they'd open up again.
They'd be back. Was there anything else you could do besides using Milan?
Well, once you were closer, we used 76mm Carl Gustavs and, of course, 66mm anti-tank. So we used all those. We never used those against armour. They were used as bunker busters.
Yes.
There wasn't any. And so, well, there was, but there wasn't any that could get at us.
Was this something you'd practiced doing before or contemplated doing before? Or
no, we hadn't practiced it before. It came out of the out of the Goose Green Battle and the realization that we had to have something to bunker bust. And in fact, I don't know how everybody did it, but I know that how 4-2 did it, is they had an Carl Gustav gunner would have travelling with him his either one or two chaps with manpack frames, with, you know, that you probably remember the old 74mm, isn't it? Carl Gustav, not 76, 74. Used to come in sort of tubes, but he'd have stacks of those on his back, on his manpack.
Yeah.
So the chap just had to whip, and he'd just whip one out and give the gun to the next one. So he'd carry perhaps 6 or 7 of these on his back. He'd be a sort of ready use locker, so he could, you know, whack these things away.
Feed them through as quickly as possible.
Exactly. And it was a brilliant bunker buster, the 66, actually, and everybody was using them. And the other thing, of course, we came to doing, I may have covered this before, was I think we were about the first people ever to use fire teams in the British forces, which is two, instead of having the old LMG section or GPMG section and a rifle section, it was going to having two teams, both armed with automatic weapons.
So you'd have two LMG.
Yeah, and the way we did that was that the commandos that were Norway trained and allocated to Norway had the old 762 Bren LMG as well as GPMGs, because the LMG was, you know, was better in the snow because you didn't have a belt trailing in the snow.
Less sensitive to the Arctic.
So that meant that we were able to produce two automatic weapons per section.
Well, that implies a change of tactics, and it's effectively back to the old 1914 advancing by half platoon, doesn't it?
Yes, and it's by half sections.
Identical firepower in each half of the subunit.
Yeah.
Going forward, one moving and the other firing.
Exactly. But you've got much heavier weight of fire because automatic fire.
There's more automatic.
And we did that. And in fact, I mean, that. I don't know if the British Army does it now, but for a long time, fire teams were all part of the British Army teaching. And we like to think we. And two para were able to achieve it because they, before they came south, managed to acquire double the number of GPMGs that they should have.
How did they manage to do that?
I don't know. But they had two GPMGs per section.
Something that needs to be asked.
Yes, they did it by somehow skullduggery. I think the only people who couldn't do it were three, who didn't either have the extra weapons, nor did they had they had time to acquire the others.
Yeah. Now, in the old days, the way of dealing with a bunker was supposed to be that you crept up on it and put grenades in through the firing slit.
Yeah, sure.
Rather than standing off with Milan or
an
anti-tank weapon.
Yeah, well, I mean, this was better, I think. And one of the things it emphasised, which have now, of course, come into service, was the need to project high explosive further than you can throw it. And hence whatever it is that goes underneath
grenade launcher.
Grenade launcher. Which I think is very important. So
now, that's something the Americans have used a great deal in Vietnam, wasn't
it?
I think in the Second World War, I know the Japanese certainly.
They had a grenade launcher.
Japanese airborne troops, in particular, had grenade launchers.
Yes, yeah, they had grenade, and they were much feared in Burma. Ours, we had the old EY rifle. You remember
rifle
the one?
Rifle grenade.
All that was
cup discharger.
All that was a grenade with a 7-second instead of a 4-second fuse. And you took them, I mean, I've used them, you took the pin out, held the lever tightly, or you put it in the cup and then pulled the pin out. So the cup held the lever in, and then you had a cartridge, a special cartridge. I can't remember what it was called, but it was without a round on the end of
it. It was just a propellant, wasn't it?
Propellant, yeah. It was more than just the ordinary propellant. And you stuck that in, and then you put the butt on the ground and sort of did that for range, and then pulled the trigger, and then it discharged the grenade into the air.
That was a weapon that required a considerable practice to achieve accuracy.
Indeed. I mean, it wasn't one you could pop. You couldn't post a grenade in through someone's. And it came in the First World War, of course, the grenade.
Yeah.
The cup.
I think they were using it in 1916.
I think they were.
But it's rather like aiming on the point of the arrow if you're using a longbow.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, I mean, it's not all that bright, anyway, put it that way.
So you've been saying you got yourself sorted out at Tiel, you're ready to go forward, and, for a while you were waiting, you had this patrolling time. Do you think that patrolling, which was aggressive on our side, had a material effect on the enemy?
I think it wore them down. I think it lowered their morale.
So wearing them down morally rather than physically.
Yeah, I think morally. And I think it made them realise that if they were going to come and patrol against us, we would take them on, and they were putting themselves at risk by coming out and trying to play on our ground.
But then on a larger scale, if you're holding a position defensively, if you don't patrol forward of it, in effect you're giving the enemy the initiative and the advantage.
Absolutely.
because the enemy can explore and get to know your positions and find the weak points and design his
attack. Absolutely. I mean, I agree. I mean, I'm not defending them. They were wrong not to do it. I don't know why they didn't. I think they just... That was their way.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that some armies habitually do patrol and other armies do not.
Rarely. Which are the ones that don't?
Well, I don't think the Americans are so keen on patrolling as the British Army or the Germans, for that matter.
No, the Brits are keen on patrolling.
But the British Army has always been very, very keen on patrolling, partly for its moral effect, partly for its training effect, partly as a way of keeping soldiers occupied and out of trouble.
Yes, and it pays off.
And it pays off.
And I think, actually, on the whole, that we fight well at night.
That's another point, that some armies do not really like night fighting.
Like the Germans didn't.
Yeah, the night is for putting on your pyjamas and going to bed.
Because
one of the things is that it's much more difficult to exert control at night.
Sure. But you only get better at it by trying it. I mean,
if you're constitutionally disinclined to night work, then you're not going to try it enough to get good at it.
No, I think it's absolutely essential. Because even with modern night viewing devices, I still think night has a great deal to recommend it.
Well, I'm sure you can get away with more at night than you could in daylight.
Yeah, sure.
You know, even with the very best night vision equipment.
Sure, and also there's a moral thing about attacking at night, particularly if you're attacking at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning. It's a bad time to be attacked, actually.
I'm sure it is, yes.
So that's why you want to do it.
That's when spirits are at their lowest.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's the time to do it.
And if you have an enemy who do not like patrolling at night, also they will not like being attacked at night.
No.
Will be rather panic-stricken, I would say.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I think all those factors worked in our favour.
Okay, so you've been doing a lot of patrolling, you've been gathering information. Who actually collated the patrol report information? Was that Hector, your patrol?
Him
master?
And the G3 Int between them.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. Who, again, was a very experienced chap, who'd again been a company commander in the Dauphin, as a Royal Marine. So you had chaps who were highly, well, they were bloody good soldiers who were doing that, who could analyse what was being done and what the information was that was coming back, and could also see where patrols ought to go to fill the holes that one might have in the information.
And they were directing what was in effect a brigade patrol programme.
Exactly,
So you're getting a better and better picture of the enemy. In this time, again, were you getting more information or better information from central sources back home, coming down the chain of command through divisional
I'm trying to remember, because it was difficult, because once you got your info from division, the intelligence was coming from division, it was difficult sometimes to tell whether that had been acquired through some divisional source within the theatre, or whether it had been acquired from someone saying to division, hey, we've just had an intercept which says this, this and this. And quite honestly, I didn't care, as long as they gave me the intelligence, you know.
But were they giving you the intelligence?
They gave us a bit. I mean, some of it was complete bollocks.
Was it?
Yeah, I mean, about an enemy position. Well, not much, but some of it was. It was about where there might be enemy positions, where we were pretty certain there weren't any. There was no reason for them to be any there.
Was that you thinking on the basis of deduction?
It's a probability, really.
Probability, yes.
But the best intelligence, by now, you see, was the contact intelligence we were getting from breasting up against the enemy.
What's the next phase then? You've got
the
moment is approaching.
The next phase is really the break in battle for those objectives. I don't know whether we want to go on now or take it later. What do you think?
But I think that's probably a separate phase, and
we might
reserve that for another.
Yeah, do you think?
I think so, yes. I think it will be a story that has its own internal integrity.
Exactly. Yes. And I think, one also sort of have a pause and think about it, maybe.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
I think...